Hey, it's Jed Hearn, host of Wizards, Warriors, and Words. If you're enjoying the writing advice on this show, you might like my new podcast, The Jed Hearn Show, where every week I share the best fantasy writing advice that I've learned from publishing 3 fantasy novels and a best-selling video game. There's over 12 episodes that you can listen to right away, including my top 10 fantasy books of all time, how to make fantasy names that don't suck, 2 rules that make writing effortless, and my complete summaries of Brandon Sanderson's and Neil Gaiman's writing classes, and much more. Check it out by searching for The Jed Hearn Show in your podcast app.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Wizards, Warriors, and Words, a fantasy writing advice podcast. I'm Jed Hearn, author of The Thunder Heist, and I'm joined by my fellow writers, starting with Michael R. Fletcher.
Oh, that's me. Michael R. Fletcher, author of the Manifest Delusions books.
And Dirk Ashton.
I am Dirk Ashton, even though I just now noticed that Mike's got Dirk Ashton down at the bottom on his screen. I wish I was Peter V. Brett. But I wrote the Paternus trilogy.
And we have the real Peter V. Brett right here in the flesh.
Hi. Hi, I'm Peter V. Brett, author of Demon Cycle series from Delray Books. I was going to make some sort of flesh joke, but then like I just
I lost it.
There was a joke there, and I just missed it.
Just floated away in the ether. That's all right. That's all right. And today in this episode, last episode, we had Peter on and we just kind of talked generally about his books, which was awesome. And in this episode, I thought we could talk a little bit about your writing process, Peter, because it sounds like you started off writing in a very interesting fashion. And is it true that you used to write a lot of your book on basically like a BlackBerry phone while on the subway in New York back in the day?
It is true. It is true. I wrote the first draft of The Painted Man, which would later become The Warded Man, at home on a computer in my spare time. And I sent that off to an agent who then rejected it and then but asked if I had anything else. And I sent him another book and he rejected that too. But then he said, hey, you know, that Painted Man book has a lot of potential, but it has a lot of big structural problems that come from the fact that you clearly are a self-taught author and are making amateur mistakes. And it was, you know,
wow,
it was like sort of a gut punch, but it was
off.
Also a gut punch where it's like, you know, it was like, you need to level up and you can, and I believe that you can, and you have something here that you can work with, but you've got to level up. And he gave me this book on writing called Writing to Sell by Scott Meredith. And I read it and it had a lot of really good advice about story structure and the emotional arc of a story. And I looked at the draft that I had of this book and realized that it needed a lot of work. So I effectively cut 60% of the book and threw it away and left only the core story. And then wrote out like a bulleted outline skeleton around that of what I needed to write from scratch. Whole new characters, to explore different parts of the world and like whole new storylines. Like there's a lot to do. But at the time, like I had a job and I had a girlfriend and I had a life, and like in New York, like I was working until probably 6 p.m. I didn't leave work till at least 6 p.m. And then, you know, I had to commute home and I had to spend time with my partner and, you know, do all the life stuff. And I just didn't have a lot of time to write. But I had this big agent who was saying like, hey, you've got potential. You can do this, you know, get in there. And so I realized that like I had to make time somewhere, like something in my life had to go in order to create this little bubble of time to write.
So, partner, and she was out of there.
Yeah,
quit my job, moved under a bridge.
I gave up my reading time on the subway commute to and from work. So I lived in Brooklyn. I worked in Times Square. The commute on a good day was 45 minutes. Sometimes it could be an hour and a half if there were like subway problems or whatever. And I would get on the train with like a big ass fucking fantasy novel, like Robert Jordan or something. And I would just, you know, put my headphones on and read. And I didn't really care if the train took too long because I loved reading. And that was like, that was my quiet time during the day when I didn't have to talk to anyone. But that was the only thing that could really go at the time. And so I had a Windows phone. This was like before the iPhone was a thing. So it wasn't a BlackBerry, but it was very similar. It was like a Windows phone. It had like a full, QWERTY keyboard with like the real buttons where you'd press the button and you would like feel like a little haptic. Yep. So you knew the button, the button had been pressed. And it had a big screen and a very scaled down version of Microsoft Word where you could type on the phone. And then when you plug the phone into its dock, remember when phones had docks, like you'd plug it into its dock and it would sync with the computer and update the file. And then you could open up that same file on your computer and type into it and then sync it back and have it. And so it was very easy to toss it back and forth. You couldn't do big files. And so I broke the book into individual chapters and I would load, you know, one or two chapters onto the phone. And I would get on the train in the morning and I would like shove an old lady out of the way so I could get a seat and put my headphones on. And I would just like put my head down and write for 45 minutes. I was writing about 300 words on the way to work and about 300 words on the way home from work. And then I would get home and sync it back to my computer and like fix all of the thumb typos and then write like another 400 words so that I could end the day at about 1,000 words a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for a year. And I would say that 60% of The Warded Man was written in that fashion. And even the chapters that I carried over from the previous version got edited and rewritten quite heavily. And so after a year of doing that, I had that final version of The Warded Man and I sent that back to my agent. And this time he was very excited and eager about it. And we went right to market.
I cannot imagine an agent taking the time to do that these days.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never heard a story like that before. It's these days, I mean, I think I started querying the first time like back in 2008, 2009, you know, and it's, if you got a rejection, you were like, yeah, you took the time to reject me.
Sure.
You know, you just never heard back from a lot of them. And I mean, to this day, that's still true, but to get like, yeah, you have potential. And I can see where that you can do this and to give you that nudge and just to take the time. That's kind of amazing.
Well, two things about that. One, my agent, Joshua Bilmes, does do that sometimes. Like, not often. Like, he only takes on a new client, you know, once every other year or so. But he absolutely does sort of try and find young writers who haven't quite leveled up to professional levels but are almost there and nudge them over the finish line. I've seen him do that with several promising young authors. Brandon Sanderson, not the least among them.
Holy shit. Okay.
And so there's that. But then there's also the fact that I live in New York City, and I went to a Science Fiction Writers of America Mill and Swill event in South Street Seaport in, like, God, I don't know, like 2003 or something. And at the bar, like, I was hanging out with my friend Mike Cole, and he told me, hey, that guy over there, that's Joshua Bilmes. He's a big agent. You should go over and talk to him and tell him about your books. And I was like, shh, I'm not fucking doing that. Are you kidding me? There's no way I'm going to do that. I didn't feel that I was writing at a professional level at that point either. Like, I knew that it was what I wanted to do, but I still hadn't quite unlocked the box. So I had about four novels that I had written that had really good parts in them, but they also just had terrible third act problems or just meandered into side places that they didn't need to go or whatever. And they just weren't professional level. So I wasn't prepared to have that conversation, but then Mike sort of just shoved me over and he was like, deal with it, dude. And so I like had a conversation with Joshua, like at the
sounds
bar.
Sounds like Mike.
You know, and he asked me, like, he was there, you know, like networking. So he was happy to chat with me for like a minute or two. And he asked me to tell him about my book, and I did. And he was like pretty excited by the premise. And so he was like, you know, that sounds really good. Send it to me. And I was like, I'm not ready to send it to you. I don't think that I'm writing at a professional level. And he looks me in the eye and he goes, you don't reject books. I reject books. So you send me the book and I'll tell you if it's good enough or not.
Nice.
And I was like, okay, fair deal. And so I sent it to him and he wrote me this long letter about how it was not good enough.
But it was like a big disappointment compared to the conversation.
It's true. And so I think that, you know, my elevator pitch or whatever when I met him was good enough. And also, I think when an agent chooses to work with you, it's not just your book. Like, your book is absolutely part of the equation and probably the biggest part. But they also want to know that you're a sane person and that you'll be easy to work with and that you're not going to, like, go off and do something that, you know, like go off message and, like, you know, mess things up or like
now they want to know that you'll be a business partner. Fletcher doesn't have an agent right now.
It's that they want you to be sane, Claus. Like, right. That's asking a bit much.
That's a tough one.
So I think that there was something of an interview going on there where, like, Joshua got a sense of the kind of person I was, and like I'm sure that was a factor. You know, I don't think it was every factor, but I do think that, like, say, it's the same thing with publishers. You know, like, they want to know that you're going to be someone that they can work with and not somebody who's like just a pain in the ass all the time. And so it's not the only factor, but it's definitely a factor. And so maybe the fact that he took the time to interact with me after that was in some way related to the fact that I had, like, impressed him that I was like a sane and decent person as well as like a creative. But I don't know. You'd have to ask him for the real answer.
Yeah. Well, being good to people is just good general advice for new writers anyway. Don't be a dick.
That's really good advice. Best advice you can have in any profession.
Yeah.
And that's been my approach to my professional career is like create this fictional Peter Brett who is very outgoing when in fact I am very introverted and just like be myself, but like myself is kind of a nice person. And so I just try to be nice to everybody and like, you know, not seek out conflict just to like create clicks and likes and shares or whatever. And it's worked for me.
Yeah, I gotta say the digital thing, this sort of setup makes it a lot easier. I would and could never do this if we all sat down in a room together. It would be so very different than sitting in my office in my comfortable space. Also extremely introverted. So it is so much easier to be, apparently friendly at a nice safe remove when it, you know, so you 20 were complete- minutes from now, it's like, okay, bye-bye.
So you were like completely faking it when we were hanging out in Indianapolis?
Dude, I was faking it so hard. I can't tell you didn't know I was faking.
Because we're all faking it. Everyone is faking it. Like, you don't become a writer because you're like a super social person, you know? Like, it's like being a writer is a very like I'm alone with my thoughts kind of job. And so it doesn't mean that you don't like people. It doesn't mean that you can't get along with people. It just means that like you're also very comfortable being alone. And so the publishers, when you're dreaming of being a writer, you don't realize that like, in addition to writing books, there's like a dance on a ball in front of a crowd aspect of it that they don't, that nobody prepares you for. Like there's no training for it. There's no like, they just shove you in front of a room, hopefully full of people, and then you have to figure it out. And so I absolutely like, it was really hard in the beginning. And then like after a couple of book tours, like I just, you get to a point on, when you're on a book tour, you can get to a point where you're just so tired that like you don't have the energy to be anxious anymore. And that lets you just go out in front of people and just roll. And then once you've done that a few times, like you get better at it. And like you get like a shtick where like people ask you where you get your ideas from and you've got like a funny answer because like you've been asked it 1,000 times. And like, so every author that I know has sort of created this alternate identity, you know, their author self, who can go out and be social and be more extroverted. And then there's their real self, which like, as soon as that social event is over, they like, I can't talk to anyone for the next 12 hours. Like, you learn to spend all of your social battery in a 2-hour bar session, and then you go back to your hotel room and don't talk to anyone.
Yeah, I'm pretty outgoing, but when I go to like cons, like Worldcon, and it's just like so many people that I know or want to meet or new people I meet, and even early on, just trying to meet some people and get to know somebody and talk to people about books and writing, it was people think that I'm much more of an extrovert, and there are times when I just have to disappear and go back to my hotel room and just sit quietly, not look at my phone, not do anything. So it's it takes a lot of energy to be up like that all the time.
Even then, even when that's how you really feel, you know, like, a lot of times, like I'm so jazzed to be around people that like speak the same language that I do, you know, like, about like books and nerdy shit that like,
Not faking it. You're real. You're talking stuff, but still that's exhausting. And after like a couple hours, you walk out or you go to the bathroom or something and realize, hopefully, fuck, I'm exhausted.
It's right? It's just spending your whole social battery like in a very short period of time.
Peter, I'd love to talk a bit more about your writing process, because obviously that first book, you were writing it while you were, you know, on the subway. How did things change for the second book? Was it the same process again because you were still at the day job? Coming years.
What was that?
I was just going to say, first, how long was it before you were able to write full time, to quit the day job?
I transitioned.
Your first book came out.
I transitioned very quickly, but I think that that is not the norm, and I think that people should not expect that to be the norm. And so, like, I sold The Warded Man in, let's say, June of 2007 to Random House. And like, you know, it was nice money, but it wasn't change your life money. You know, so I still had a day job. Like I I had a job in pharmaceutical publishing that I didn't like, but it was a good steady job, and I made good money because pharmaceutical industry like has money, and I learned a lot of publishing skills. Like I was the production supervisor, so like I was dealing with the printers, and I was art directing things, and building websites and making promotional items and that sort of thing. So it was all useful, transferable skills. But I didn't like the job. And so I sold the book in 2007. And as I said, like it wasn't enough money for me to even consider getting rid of my job. But then my agent was like, okay, now that we've sold it in the US, we're going to try for some international sales. I wouldn't expect anything to happen right away, but you never know. So I was like, okay, I was so jazzed that I was going to be a published author. Like I didn't give a shit about anything else at that point, And so then I would say within the next 3 months, he sold the books in the UK, France, and Germany. And when the German offer came in, and Poland. And like when all of those separate deals were calculated, I looked at my finances and I was like, okay, I could responsibly, like if I turn in a book, every 18 months, and that will trigger like these, chunks of your advance to be paid. If I do that, I will make less than I'm making at my current job, but enough to pay my rent and buy food and, do all the normal things that I need to do. And so I made a decision that I would, that I could always get another job that I didn't like, because getting jobs that you don't like is not hard. I said, I have enough guaranteed money from these publishing contracts that I can, take a 2-year stint as a full-time writer and see what happens. And if at the end of that 2 years, like I don't feel comfortable, I can always, my skills will still be transferable enough that I could go back and get another, print production job or whatever. And that was 15 years ago.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Good 2-year stint then.
Yeah. But the second book, I made the decision to leave my job, but I didn't leave the job for probably another 5 or 6 months. I transitioned out very slowly. I started working part-time, letting them do a search for somebody to replace me, so I didn't leave the company in a lurch or anything. And so I was still commuting for most of that time. And so I would say about half of the second book was also written on my phone. And from that point on, I was mostly writing at a desktop computer. But now that I'd sort of broken the seal on mobile writing, I could also pull out my phone, anytime when I found myself with an hour to kill, like, I'm at the bar and like my friend's not going to show up for an hour. Okay, I can write for an hour, and I could just pull out my phone and do that. And once I was able to do that, I would find that like even now, I'll get big chunks of writing done at unexpected times just because I had a spare moment. I was like, yeah, I guess I'll write. And so that's been a really useful skill ever since. And it also allowed me to switch to writing on my iPad, which is uses sort of the same Microsoft syncing software, which is much more portable, and I just keep my iPad in my bag all the time. So anytime I have some spare time, I can just sit down and write. And so that has made me much more productive in general, I think.
Cool.
I think that's such a good piece of advice, particularly for, I know a lot of writers listening to this are, working full time at their jobs. I had one of our listeners asking me the other day, Evan was his name, and he was like, it's difficult to find time to write because, I work 40 hours a week and I'm always staring at a computer while I'm at work. And then I come home and kind of the last thing I want to do is stare at a computer some more. So really having that mindset of trying to find these little cracks and little moments of time throughout your day to jot down a couple of sentences is very useful, and it's something that I find
quite worthwhile. Story is inspiring, Peter.
Yeah, you know, it's very inspiring
all the way through. The fact that you can do that from your experience with your agent, and it is just so common. I was in the film business for many years, and it's so very common for people to kill you with kindness. And I know it happens in publishing too, where they tell you the same things that guy told you, but they don't really mean it. And then when you send it to them a year or two later, they act like they don't even know who you are. Right. I mean, that happens a lot, but the best part about your experience is that it's not all like that, right? That there are people who mean it when they say those things. And there are ways to write books when you don't have time to write books. So yeah, I'm going to have to stop whining.
I
meet your fucking deadline.
Says the guy who's currently on the fourth extension to finish his book on contract.
I can't attribute this quote because I forget who said it, but somebody like during my career told me, then in Hollywood, everything is, or in publishing, everything is is no until it's yes. And in Hollywood, everything is yes until it's no.
Oh, that's very true of Hollywood for sure. Yeah.
Publishing is very defeatist. It's like, look, you know, that is a big slush pile there. We're probably not even going to read your book. And even if we do read your book, you know, like if we don't like the first 10 pages, we're going to throw it out. You know, like there's this very oppressive sense of just like, hopelessness, and like it's a just, no.
Just the just the stories that everyone has, you know, about all these books that became huge that were turned down 20, 30, 40 times, 40 different agents.
Because the industry is inundated.
Right. And then finally somebody picked it up and then it went in, then it got in and they put out The Name of the Wind or Harry Potter. Right? It's, you know, these kinds of things happen all the time. And they just didn't give up.
But whenever you talk to people in Hollywood, it's very much just like, we're going to make this happen. And you're like, we got this. Oh, yeah. And, you know, like it's very positive and very like energetic. But and they know too that like, okay, you know, this is all fun talk, but at the end of the day, somebody has to put up $100 million to make a big special effects fantasy movie in order for us to go from like, this is a great idea to
or TV reality. Today, they spend so much money. I know you've dealt with those sorts of things along the way, but there was a saying, I lived in LA and worked there for 6 years. And, you know, we had a saying that it's not a deal when they say it's a deal. It's not a deal when they sign the deal. It's not a deal when they write you the check. It's not a deal when you deposit the check. It's not a deal until you've spent the money.
Yeah, it's, you know, you don't want to be cynical in general about your career, and you don't want to be too cynical about your industry. You want to be just cynical enough that you don't get taken advantage of, but not so cynical that you're an unpleasant person to work with, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's that fine line.
And you know, it's just interesting how like you have to change, you have to adjust fire when you're talking to book people or when you're talking to other media people.
Well, rejection is hard. Rejection is hard. And even successful authors, even amazingly successful authors like Peter V. Brett have people go on Goodreads and Amazon and write really shitty things about their books. You know, we all do. You know, it's, you can look. But I know authors who can't look at reviews, and if they do and find a bad one, it can ruin their whole week. There's a certain thickness of hide you either have to develop or you have to just stay away from that kind of thing.
I read every review of a new book that I can find for about 3 to 6 months after the book comes out.
Me too.
You know, because like, I spent 2 years working on that book. Like, I want to know what people think about it. Yep. Like, I'm not made of stone, you know, like, of course I want to know what people think about it. Yep. But I find after about 3 months, even if new reviews are steadily coming in, they've all started to sound the same. And then I start to taper off reading them, and usually
it's the same kind of praise and the same kind of, you know,
right. Or you get like those sort of very generic, like criticisms, like book two was very much a middle book. It's like, yeah, okay. It sure was. But you see that criticism all the time, you know,
yeah.
Where it's like, that's it wasn't the origin and it wasn't in the conclusion. It was very much a middle book. It's like, yeah, yeah. Sure was.
Yes, that's what the second book of a trilogy is. Well spotted. Really is.
And so, like, you start to, like, phrases like that, you start to see them over and over again. And, like, but in those first couple of weeks after a book comes out, like, I really want to know what people think. And if people write a really negative review, like, it can hurt my feelings sometimes. Or other times, I'll be more likely, like, oh, I wish I could argue with this person. Like,
yeah, but you don't dare. You yeah. don't dare. That never.
Clearly, you didn't read chapter five, or else you wouldn't have all these problems. Like,
exactly. I've never once seen that end well.
Yeah, for anyone. Of course.
For anyone.
Yeah, that way lies madness.
But I've also never once in my entire 15 years as an author, I've never once read a review of my books that made me say, "Oh, I wish I had done that differently." Never ever. And so, like. Yeah. It's become more like,
that's great.
Some people like the kind of books that Peter Brett likes and some people don't. And like, what are you going to do? Like, I don't mm-hmm. feel like it's something that I have a lot of control over and I don't feel like, oh, if only I hadn't done that one thing or if only I had, you know, changed that plot point or whatever. I've never felt that way. It's always just like, well, I guess those people don't like Peter Brett books and I can feel bad about that. But like, there's also not a lot I can do about it.
Sure. That's awesome.
That's fair enough. Maybe last kind of question before we wrap this up is, so we've talked about the kind of early ways that you were getting your writing done on the subway train. What does it look like now? What does your writing process look like for a book these days? All the way through from, like, you know, starting off with your ideas, do you outline, do you just get straight into writing? And then what does your kind of day-to-day writing look like?
It's evolved a lot over the last, I'd say 20 years. The first few books, the first four novels that I wrote were mostly just, pantser, you know, made it up as I went along. And even the first version of The Warded Man, I made up as I went along. And that was why I ended up having to throw out 60% of it, was because I made it up as I went along. And then I ended up in a place that was not where I wanted to end up. And like, you know, I went down the wrong path and like, just the latter half of the book was garbage and like didn't put the characters in a place where I wanted them to be to set up further story. It was just bad. And so after that, like when I did that rewrite and I made the, like, a bulleted list outline of where the story should be, that became my writing style. And so for every book, and it's gotten worse with every book, but, at this point, my outline, I call it a step sheet for one of my novels, is usually 150 to 200 pages long, and is just a bulleted outline of everything that happens in every chapter in specific, you know, like, here's a little witty bit of dialogue and this character does this and this, you know, these people fight and it resolves like this. And so, like, really on a granular level, I lay out the entire story. And I break that into chapters and I break that into scenes so that when I sit down to do the writing, I'm mostly focused on the emotional state of the characters. Like, how do they feel as they experience these things that I already know are going to happen? Mm-hmm. And so I don't have to worry that I'm going to paint myself into a corner. I don't have to worry that, like, I don't know what's going to happen next. I don't have to worry about, like I've already solved the big story problem at the end. And so, like, I can just focus on, like, getting in the heads of the characters and making the reader feel what the character should be feeling as they experience all of this stuff.
That's a lot. So, the same way that I have to work, because if I don't know what's going to happen, I just ramble. And, but do you ever have to change it? Do you ever find that you need to change some things as you go? 'Cause that happens to me every time.
Sometimes, not a lot, but some, like, every once in a while, like, you'll get, like, little changes in the early sections will build up to a point where you get to a chapter and like, okay, now I have to change this whole chapter because it doesn't make sense anymore. Right. Or like the plot will have your character do something, but then when you're writing the scene, it just doesn't feel right. And you're like, you know what? They probably wouldn't do that. And I would be forcing them to do something that's out of character for the sake of the plot. And I don't want to do that. I'm going to turn this light on because it's the sun is setting here and it's getting dark, but it's going to make me sort of weird and yellow. So,
no, that's perfect. That looks good, actually. Nice.
So, where was I? I'm sorry.
Oh, we were talking,
about your outlining process and then your writing process more generally.
So then, so over the course of the series, like as I was writing one book, I would be coming up with ideas for how I wanted the story to progress and fleshing out the outline of the subsequent books so that by the time I'm ready to write the next book, most of that outline is already done. And then I go through it a few times just to make sure that it's really strong. And then I start layering prose on over that. So it's almost like I have a first draft in the outline because a lot of times I'll pull full chunks of writing out of that outline and just paste them in. And then I just work my way chronologically through the manuscript till I get to the end. And there, you know, there are patches of time when I don't write at all, like when I'm on book tour or when I'm doing promotion for a new book that's about to launch, or when I'm editing. I don't tend to also be writing new stuff. But when I am focused on, you know, like when I'm in that period of the writing cycle where I'm actually writing, I try and shoot for 1,000 words a day, 5 days a week. I feel like 1,000 words is small enough that there's really no good excuse to not be able to write 1,000 words in a day. But it's big enough that it scales up pretty quickly. And so if you just consistently do 5,000 words a week, every week, like after a year, you have a book. And so that's like my overall plan on how to do it. But then real life gets in the way because I've got a 5-year-old and I've got, you know, like we had this weird pandemic thing that happened and like the whole family moved into my home office, like, you know, because like I would just have the apartment to myself and everybody would go to school or work. And then all of a sudden everybody's in the house and, you know, my partner, Lauren, like, is in meetings all day. And so she's sort of like, not shouting, but she's using her like mobile phone voice all day, every day. And like, I can't write to that. And so I started staying up super late at night during the pandemic and writing, you know, I would write from like 11 PM to 3 AM or something because it was the only time the house was quiet. And then I would sort of zombie my way through the day and steal a nap somewhere and then, you know, do it again every night. So it's always had to adapt to just whatever was going on in my life at the time.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, that's probably a good place to start wrapping things up. Before we finish this episode up, Peter, do you want to let everyone know about the latest book that you've just released a couple of weeks ago?
Book one of the Nightfall Saga, The Desert Prince, came out in hardback in 2021 and then releases in trade paperback August 16th, 2022, which I guess is a couple of weeks ago now. The Nightfall Saga can be read without having read the Demon Cycle series. Everything you need to enjoy that series is right there in book one, The Desert Prince. So you can start there. But there is also the original series that it's a spinoff from, which is 5 books and complete and ready to binge.
Awesome.
Awesome. And do you want to give us like a quick pitch of The Desert Prince?
So The Desert Prince takes place 15 years after the conclusion of the Demon War at the end of the Demon Cycle series. It features 2 main characters told in first person, Olive Paper and Darren Bales. Olive Paper is the intersex child of 2 characters from the previous series and has to explore that identity over the course of the series while also having some pretty amazing adventures. Darren Bales is also the product of two characters in the previous series and is born with magic powers that are as much of a detriment as an advantage in his life. His senses are so acute that he has sort of a supernatural form of autism where he takes in too much input for him to really process. And so when he's having a conversation with someone, he's getting all of this input, like how they smell and what they had for breakfast and where they've been and like what their heartbeat sounds like and are they lying, and it can become so overwhelming that it's hard for him to have a direct conversation with somebody because he's trying to process all of this other information while they're just having a verbal conversation. And so it's been sort of interesting to explore those two characters and sort of see how they fit into this already established world in their own way. That's kind of a rambling answer.
No, yeah. It's awesome.
And you know,
no, that's awesome.
And how their parents screwed them up in a different way than their parents screwed them up, and the result is they have to go off and have adventures.
Awesome. Sounds great.
Great. Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you coming on the
show.
Thank
you for having me.
And yeah, everyone listening or watching, thank you for checking out this episode, and we'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, man.
Bye.
Ciao.
As we end this episode, I wanted to give a big shout out to all our Patreons who help support the show, and an extra special shout out to our legendary wizard patrons, Taylan and Daniel. If you want to help support the show and get access to a huge library of exclusive patron-only episodes, go to patreon.com/wizardswarriorswords. You can find the link in the show notes below.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.